Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for this week, ending Friday, the 24th of July. We, Mon, Bron and Daniel, are on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 to 9am, broadcast live on Wurundjeri Country from Melbourne, Australia. Coming up on the pod this week, Bron is finally embracing her inner Queenslander and proudly ordering big frothy cappuccinos. And did you know that Daniel invented the handstand? Perhaps we should have asked choreographer Stephanie Lake, who was in to talk about her new work, Vista, which is showing at Malthouse.
We had Besha in this week to celebrate the warm gruffness of late Mario's waiter, Massimo D'Sora, and the team discussed what should you do if your plane's going down? Cry or giggle?
We were all ears as Dr. Jen delivered the latest weird science on mobile phones, and iconic Australian film editor Jill Bilcock pulls focus as she enthralls us with her life in film.
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
I did something on the weekend I haven't done for a very long time. I ordered a cappuccino.
Oh, a mugaccino?
No, just the cap.
Okay, you didn't
just
go the full.
No, I didn't go
2001.
Full. Yeah. No, I've done it. I'm back on it, back on the caps. I got bullied out of cappuccinos when I moved down here.
Oh, yeah, Melburnians, we couldn't handle it.
Could, yeah, every time I went for coffee with friends, like, what are you getting? I was like, oh, I might get a cappuccino. Oh, you get a cappuccino. And then so I've been pretending to be a flat white drinker, and I'm just not. I just, aww, you know, you can take the girl out of Queensland, but you can't take the chocolate sprinkles out of her coffee. And I'm getting them back.
That's good.
It's weird because obviously I support whatever decision you choose and however you choose to identify in a caffeine sense. But it will be difficult if I have to go have to get you a coffee and have to say cappuccino.
You will have to say cappuccino, yeah.
And you'll say, not for me. It's for a friend.
Exactly.
She's out from out of town.
Come on, it's on the menu. I'm allowed to order it.
How would you feel if you got given a cappuccino with no chocolate? Because that's what they, you know, that's the traditional cappuccino. It doesn't come with chocolate. Would you be in? Would you ask for it?
Throw it in their face.
Like, is that what you like about it?
The chocolate?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me one thing that chocolate doesn't make better. Besides, famously, your body wash.
Exactly. Yeah, well, you not at my KK. It's terrible chocolate body wash. Still circulating.
No, I like the cappuccino where you go halfway, chocolate sprinkles, finish.
That's how I used to make it. I used to love doing it. I actually still love people ordering cappuccinos because they were the most fun to make.
The most fun to drink. They're so good. And I know Melbourne is the coffee capital of the country, as it rightly so. Coffee is amazing down here.
Look at you scrambling.
Oh, but God, that was pathetic.
But
feels like watching a politician.
I will say.
But go on.
But I don't think you know your coffee as well as you think.
Oh, well.
Mm-hmm. As someone who was a very average barista, I had enough people come up to me and be like, that's the best coffee I've ever had. And I thought, I know it's not because I made it.
Maybe they were from Ipswich.
I had a guy order a magic, which I didn't know how to make. And I had to be like, I'm just actually out of lids. And then I hid under the coffee cart and Googled how to make a magic. And then I came back up, made some kind of atrocity. And I was like, one magic. And he came back. He said, that was the best coffee.
Are you kidding?
Wow.
I've ever had.
Maybe it was. Maybe you lucked into it.
Maybe. Beginner's luck.
You actually learned what it was. Maybe baristas are out there thinking they're making it, but they never Googled it.
Yeah. I'm actually the only one who really knows how to make a magic.
A magic is actually what I think is my ideal coffee, but I've never ordered it because I can't bring myself to say it.
I 100%. I had one once and I was like, I was actually annoyed how good it was. Mm. I was like, but I can never go and say magic.
No, I was like, can I get a strong fat wine? Can you just leave a little bit of milk off the top? I won't say the word.
Is it like the Barassi line? Can you get a magic in like Albury?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
If you are getting a magic in Albury, they've Googled it.
Yeah, okay.
But I also had a woman come up to me once and she went, what milks have you got? And I was like, I rattled them off. I said, we got almond, we got oat, we got soy, we got full cream, we got skim. She said, can I get a quarter of each?
Oh, my God.
And I said, you would like a quarter of all five milks? Huh? And she said, yes. And I said, sure.
And then did you charge her the extra 50 cents for each non-dairy milk she got? Your coffee will be $12.50.
Yeah. Why are we using the word quarter?
She did.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So mathematically it doesn't add up.
Yeah, it's a mathematically impossible coffee, mm-hmm. but I made it.
Here is your 125% full.
Wow. Do you think she having a laugh?
No.
Okay. Oh, really?
No.
She wasn't just trying to stir you or something?
No.
She's like, I want to see which one I like best, so I'm going to mix them all together.
It was really strange. And but I made it for her. She came back and got another one.
Really? The next day?
No, like half an hour later.
Did you make the same thing again?
Yeah. Because it was like a free coffee, like it was like at an event.
Oh, she's really taking the piss.
It's free. Yeah.
And it's I'm going to have every milk.
Because she's like,
and I'm going to have it twice.
Yeah, and I'd never pay for this.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do it now while I'm free.
There should be some kind of hotline you can call. Not police without sirens.
So one step below police without sirens.
Someone's just taking the piss and weeding me out.
And milk is involved. She wants all five milks in her coffee.
An I and a Y. I mean, all of them.
So have you broken the back now and you'll think you'll continue it, or did you just need to show yourself that you could do it, and now that you have done it, you can revert back to a more traditional Melbourne coffee experience?
No, I'm on it. Well, I'm on the caps now, back on the caps, and Liz is going to be in for a rude shock when she comes back from overseas.
Well, to be honest, you spent time in London, like cappuccino, you know, they haven't caught up nowhere with cool coffee. And when you go to Italy, cappuccino is what you order, because if you order a cafe latte, it comes in like a bowl. Yeah. I learned to order cappuccinos in Italy. That's the best coffee, like if you drink a milk.
What about a takeaway cappuccino? Doesn't the lid ruin some of the fun of it?
Not if they put the chocolate in halfway and chocolate on top.
Oh, okay.
But have you ever been to the place where they give you the cappuccino, but it's like actual shaved chocolate on top?
Oh, yeah. I've seen that when other people order it.
Yeah.
Missing out. Everyone's missing out. I think it is the better coffee.
So how far are you from mocha territory? I feel like you're really going in for the chocolate side of this. Just go full.
No, I'm not going to go. No, I don't need a mocha.
Get a mocha. Oh, okay.
I just want a little bit of a sprinkle.
Just a little.
Just a little.
Mm.
And I like the foam.
Maybe you should order a baby chino, which is just the top.
A friend of mine, Tim Hewitt, his mum is convinced she invented the baby chino.
Okay.
And how? Maybe she did.
Maybe. She thinks up in Brisbane.
Oh, Queensland coffee first, coming again.
She said, how about I just get the milk foam? Before anyone else was doing it.
And
then everyone copied her. For Tim, I guess.
Baby Tim.
Oh. Baby Tim. Baby Tim, who was the first baby in the world.
To have
a baby chino.
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay. I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
How cosmopolitan.
Isn't it?
Mm.
I know. And look,
because
part of my heritage.
I just used to steal the foam off my parents' cappuccinos. And now you're paying $2 for that.
You know what?
It's a scam.
Is foam in Queensland like mid-strength beer? Like it's hot. It's too hot for
it's
full strength.
It's too hot for a whole milk, for too much steamed milk.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe
so we aerate
right.
it?
Yeah, because you got to drink it quickly, yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Mm. That could be it. You might be onto something.
Yeah. I'd told Gabriel I invented the handstand.
Were you doing one at the time?
No, that's the thing. You don't actually have to do it.
I was like, I didn't know you could handstand.
I just thought it would be
next
a really good idea.
Yeah.
When Stephanie Lake comes in later, I want you handstanding in that photo.
Yeah. Trademark.
Tell her, you know that here.
And no one can disprove it.
So how did it even come up with Gabriel?
I don't know.
Was he trying to learn to do it?
But he quizzes me every once in a while. Like, he's like, did you really invent the handstand? And I did. Like, even if it's like a Leonardo da Vinci, he invented the helicopter, really. He didn't build it, but there were the prints.
Oh, yeah. So you drew sticky little stick figures.
I'm like the Vitruvian man.
Did you draw it, or was it like, was it like Mr. Squiggle? And you're like, it's upside down.
That's right. Anyway, no one can miss me. It's me and Tim. Get off our back.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Stephanie Lake is a Helpman Award-winning dancer turned choreographer, resident choreographer for the Australian Ballet, former artist-in-residence for the Dresden Ballet and founder of Stephanie Lake Company, whose works include The Chronicles, Manifesto and Colossus, which have toured to over 16 countries, wowing audience in some of the world's most prestigious theatres. Now, Stephanie Lake Company has a brand new work, Vista, which wrestles with the slipperiness of perception and opens this week at Malthouse Theatre. And to tell us about it, the hemisphere-hopping former sandwich maker joins us now. Stephanie, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Were you an elegant sandwich maker?
I was a generous sandwich maker. There would be people that would come to the sandwich shop just to get me because I was over generous with the salmon and the turkey. Yeah, oh, I didn't realise I wasn't paying the bills. You know, I want to make people happy. So the brie was thick.
Yeah.
And then my boss was like, "I think I need to retrain you."
But you're bringing people in, so
People in the door. But yeah,
so when you're a dancer, is being a dancer like being a present? You're always referred to as a dancer, even if you don't dance every day.
Not anymore, I don't think. It's been nearly 10 years, I think, maybe a bit less. But yeah, it's been a good stint since I've been on the stage. So I think I can let that go.
Do you miss it?
Like, not at all.
You're not there in the background watching.
No,
thinking,
I really genuinely don't. I live through the dancers that I work with, and I love all of the adrenaline and the camaraderie and stuff that they get to experience backstage. But I don't miss people looking at me in that way, honestly. It was fun. I did it for a long time. I performed professionally for nearly 20 years.
Mm.
So I feel very satisfied. I got a lot of that. But it's a lot to be looked at all the time. You're not always in the mood.
And a lot unhealthy. So don't hear that from a performer often.
Yeah, and even like the training and all that. You know, it's like decades of
and your joints.
Kind of looking at yourself in the mirror and being looked at, and you get to a stage where, I don't know, for me, I was over it. There'd been enough of that. And I just started to get so much reward and satisfaction out of making my own shows, and so it just transferred to being a choreographer. Now I get looked at as a choreographer, and actually that's even more terrifying. In the studio, Every day in the studio is a bit like a performance.
Did you always want to get into choreography, or did you surprise yourself?
Yeah, I've been
yourself?
Choreographing since I was a teenager. I've been, you know, I was thinking about it. I was thinking, yeah, I've always been a little show off. Like I even at school assembly, I'd be like, I'll put something on, and I'd put together a little dance for assembly or something. Even when I wasn't really a trained dancer. So, yeah, I've been choreographing for a long, long time. Mm-hmm.
Did you dance to Fight the Cold at all, ever?
Well, I grew up in Canada, in the prairies of Canada, and actually, it's funny, I was warmer there than when we moved to Tasmania because houses are insulated in Canada.
They
and
have to accept
well
that
heated.
Winter exists.
Yeah, and so I remember being quite warm in Canada inside, even in the winters would get to minus 40, literally. I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it? The cars would be covered in snow. The fence was covered in – I could walk over the fence in winter, over the snow. Yeah, it just became a hill. but, yeah, then moving to Tassie, wow, that was cold because it's drafty. And
at what age?
8.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, sometimes, dancing to shake the chills away. Yeah, totally, totally.
We want to know about Vista. What are you getting off? What itch – are you scratching creatively with Vista?
Yeah, good question. Well, it's slightly inspired by my foray into the ballet world, which is recent for me. I'm not a ballet trained dancer, but like you said, I'm the resident at the Australian Ballet now, and also Dresden Ballet, and there's this convention in contemporary dance that all shows are 60 minutes long and there's no interval, and that's just kind of it's an accepted convention. But in ballet, they always have intervals, and they always have they're much longer shows, and there's always the division with an intermission. And I don't know, it became this kind of the core of this show. I thought, okay, I'm going to play with structure. Let's have an interval. It's a radical idea, everyone. Let's try an interval. And the interval became kind of the purpose and driver of the show. So what I'm doing is I'm making a complete show from the audience's perspective. So they see a show in act one, they go away for interval, and they come back and they see that same show again, but it's as if they're watching it through completely different glasses or goggles. It's like a new filter on everything you've seen before. You see it again, but it's changed, it's altered, it's flipped, it's reversed. And the creative itch for me was like this really fun choreographic game, like a puzzle, how to make two versions of one show. Yeah. And it's just it's an interest of mine just in how we subjectivity really, like how we can all just so radically see things in different ways and on the micro level and also on the global level, how we've just kind of been pulled into these algorithmic polarities where we're just seeing the world and seeing things in such radically different,
love it. Different lenses. Could you have done even different versions?
Oh, totally. Yeah, there are 1,000 versions of every section of this show. So it was the task was partly just to make the choices about what lens we put on different sections, whether it is that it's completely different music. Are we going from something clinical to something like operatic, which was a really fun one? Are we going from something that's got a forward momentum to something in reverse and making the choices about which section gets which filter?
Does dance leave much room for improvisation?
Yeah, for me, yes. Not for everyone. Some choreographers are completely prescriptive and every single move, every moment is choreographed. In my shows, there's generally a bit of flex. I like for the performers to have a bit of, to keep it alive, for there to be a sense of kind of playfulness, even on stage, where there can be little shifts or choices that are made night by night. And that feels healthy to me, especially in a long run or a show that runs for years. It's really good to have those moments where there can be some, just a little bit of chaos is good, actually. It's largely very, very choreographed. Even the moments of chaos are within really tight structures. Sometimes it looks like bedlam on stage, but we've rehearsed the bedlam. The bedlam's rehearsed, yeah.
Do you read books on leadership and stuff like that?
Absolutely not. No. No, I'm not a self-helpy kind of person. That's not self-help really, is it? But no, the leadership I've just learned from my mentors and peers and just by doing it, getting things wrong and right over the years.
Have you ever asked a dancer, do you only ask dancers to do things that you could have done or have done?
Absolutely not. No, the opposite.
I wonder what this would look like.
Totally. Because as I get older and I get further and further away from my own physical capabilities, it's much more in my imagination. Well, you know, I still physically demonstrate as much as I can and I kind of burst out movement sequences and get the thing started. I set things in motion, but then the dancers that I'm working with are so, so far beyond any capability I had even 10 years ago. You know, every generation just gets more and more skilled, faster, higher, deeper, longer, more frightening. Like it's like sports people get faster and higher. It's the same with dancers. They just what they can do now is way beyond what any of my generation could do.
Well, you were conscious of the audience and being looked at. What's your advice to cope with that if someone had the same trepidation that you had
about being a performer?
Well,
like anything, there's good and bad, and so you just the thrill, there are bad things about being looked at, but the thrill of it going well and receiving applause and all of that is really an amazing experience. It's such a high to feel like a show's gone well, especially the kind of it's the group effort. That's what I miss, actually, is the feeling of doing things together, of getting it's such a collaborative art form. You're so intertwined with people. And so just to lean into that, to love that because it doesn't last forever. So that deep connection with other people on stage and then hopefully the roar of applause at the end. It's pretty nice, I got to tell you. It's pretty amazing. It makes it all worth it.
And what about the soundscape for Vista?
Oh, well, it's amazing, of course. It's done by it's done by my partner, Robin Fox, who we've been collaborating for long time now, made dozens of shows. So, but this one's been really interesting, a fun game for him as well, because he's had to think about what the counterpoint is to what kind of the opposite is, or what the reverse is of a particular mm-hmm. piece of music. And so a fun task all round for all of the designers. And yeah, the music's amazing. It's got a huge breadth of sound worlds, because that's what this show needed.
Mm. Mm. When he first made music for you, was he keeping time, or?
Yeah. We met and we weren't intending to become collaborators. We weren't intending to become partners even, but you know, these things happen. But he just kind of helped me out initially, because I was making a piece. This is a long time ago. I was making a piece and I was just in the studio going da, just leading the dances.
Like a metronome.
Just keeping the metronome, yeah, just trying to keep it steady. And he was just a fly on the wall, just in the studio watching what was happening. He said, "I can help you with that if you want. Do you want me to, I can do a track." And he did so much more than a metronome. It was so cool. And, yeah, that was the beginning of something
pretty
magic.
Did he ever confess that he had a crush on you before the metronome?
Oh.
It was the metronome that sealed the deal. Like, listen to that timekeeping.
Yeah, it was fairly obvious. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Vista, it kicks off 22nd of July. Oh, my God.
I know. Don't make me nervous. Yeah, we've got two previews, Wednesday and Thursday this week, and then the official opening is Friday, and then we run to the following weekend.
Oh, how exciting.
It's so exciting.
And then if it catches off, will you live with this for a long time?
Well, we do. It's already caught on. We've got Sydney, a season at Carriage Works in Sydney the week after we finish, and then we're in Brisbane
All right.
Powerhouse as well. And then we hope, of course, you know, we'll see if it gets picked up for elsewhere in the world or the country, then we'd love that.
All right, well, you got to catch it now. Head to the Malthouse websites for tickets to Vista, which is on through the 1st of August. We've been speaking with the founder of Stephanie Lake Company. Stephanie Lake, thanks so much.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Triple R. I'm hungry. I want something to eat. Something with a crunch and very sweet.
Well, for Food Included, a good morning with Besha Riddell back on Breakfast This Morning. Besha.
Good morning.
You've been out and about.
I have. I've been literally all around the world.
Wow.
I got a round the world ticket and now I'm back.
Incredible. and you returned to some sad news.
I did, yeah. Right after, you know, we have celebrated the 40th anniversary of Mario's, and in the middle of that celebration was Massimo De Sora, the first longest employee. He was hired 33 days after Mario's opened, and he passed away last Monday, and was supposed to retire on the 28th of June and never got to that retirement party, and they held a retrospective of his work. He's actually quite an amazing photographer, and he didn't get to that either, but I started hearing about this early last week and got into Mario's to speak to some people and wrote an article. And I don't think that I've ever had such a huge reaction to an article that I've written, certainly not in this particular way. There are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments on all of Good Food social media about it, which is just, to me, it's really lovely, especially, you know, I think we tend to valorize sometimes chefs or restaurateurs when they go, but it's pretty rare for a waiter to have that much impact.
Mm. As a vacant table?
Yeah, for 40 hours after he passed, there's a table at the end of the kind of at the end of the bar at Mario's against the wall, and they took the chairs away and put a candle and a picture of him. And I was there on Thursday morning, and there was just still a stream of people coming in and talking to the owners and talking to the other staff, and everybody is just really, really sad. And it just shows, I mean, I think he just touched so many lives, but I think he also really set I think I've talked here again before about this style of waiting tables that is very, very Melbourne. And Massimo was from Rome, and I was actually in Rome recently, and I could see the progression of like the Roman style service that he brought to Melbourne and then kind of changed a little bit. And now I think of it as a really Melbourne thing, but I feel like he kind of invented it, this almost, you know, there's this slight like negging that happens where you're like, he's going to be a little bit kind of gruff and mean to you and make you want to like him and make him want to like you, you know? And then if you can kind of get into the good side, the good graces, then it's like the most magical thing, you know? And I feel like that was just such a big part of, certainly for me, going to Mario's is like, if you could be on Massimo's good side, then you were like, you know, in the cool club.
And did he set the tone for the other staff? Did they, do you think they tried to emulate his style?
Absolutely. I think certainly, especially kind of in the early to middle years, I think that kind of like breezy, slightly gruff, but like, if you're in, like that's definitely a thing with, and I think not just at Mario's, but like across Melbourne. I have been eating a lot at Roma recently, which is the new restaurant in Collins Street. That's supposed to be like a Roman restaurant, and they have staffed it almost completely with kind of, you know, older Italian and Greek waiters that have that same air about them, that is just like almost, it's a family thing. You feel like you're part of a family, and they're going to tease you in the same way, and they're going to, you know, make you feel welcome in the same way that family would. And I feel like that was, it's partly a cultural thing. That's partly how waiters are in Italy in some senses, but it's also very much something that Massimo, I think, helped bring to Melbourne. Mm.
There's an aura to competence sometimes as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was funny because one of the owners, Mario, was like, you know, he took some liberties that other waiters probably couldn't take. Like he was telling me that like he would try to do a whole shift without talking sometimes, and like he was like, so there's a lot of shrugging and there's like a nodding and kind of like, you know, the tilt of the head and whatever,
like, but just as a personal challenge.
Yeah exactly. But he could do it and he could get away with it like that, and you would still have a really good, you know, you would have a really good experience. So I mean, yeah, that's there is an aura to that.
Yeah, wow. And do you think there's a, in terms of his talent for photography, is there anything in his observing and his keen eye that makes you particularly adept at hospitality as well?
I mean, I think so. His photography is really interesting. It's basically this kind of style of collage that he was very, very excited about the art that, and, you know, every 3 weeks they swap out the art, and he would often take photos of the artist in front of their work and in a few different positions, and then do a collage that showed them in different areas of the restaurant, but, you know, all pasted together. And so they do have this sense, his works, of kind of seeing the whole, but with the small little moments in the whole, you know? So I do think, and it's really interesting to me that like, even in his artistic life, his muse was the restaurant, you know, and the people in it, and the artists who kind of made it come alive. And I mean, one of the saddest things about him passing before he had the chance to retire is that the plan was always for him to still come and kind of be the consigliere of the art nights. And he was very excited about that prospect to just come and sit and not have to work, but to kind of be in the middle of that scene still. And yeah, I'm really sad personally that I missed the show, because I would love to have bought one of his pieces. They're really beautiful. And especially if you love that restaurant, you know, what a cool thing to have in your house.
You could be out extremely late on Brunswick Street and see him.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He famously only worked the night shift. He never worked mornings. And He was absolutely, you would just see him hanging out front. And I had a conversation with a young woman who had just made the most unlikely but really beautiful friendship with him. She was 16 when she moved to Melbourne, didn't know many people, but moved to Fitzroy. And she just went in there every Monday night, you know, for years, and kind of wore him down. And then she said one night she was walking past it, 1 a.m. or something, and he said, oh, come in and have a beer with me. This is when she was 18. and she's only 20 now. And, like, you know, she just had this incredible, really, really lovely friendship with him that, you know, she was like, he was my introduction to Melbourne, to Fitzroy. He told me all about the neighborhood. And she basically kind of wormed her way into his heart just by waving to him on late at night when she was walking by, you know, and doing that consistently. And he finally was like, okay, you're all right.
He pioneered the silver tray.
Yes, he did. Mario was telling me that early days, you know, they would just, sometimes people would leave the change for an extra 10 cents or, you know, whatever kind of. And he said, you know, if we put the bill on a little silver tray, maybe they'll leave some tips for us. And apparently he liked to remind the younger staff that if it wasn't for him, they wouldn't probably be getting any tips. They said everything, you know, the way that they set the tables, the way that the waiters dress, which is very iconic. Like Mario said, but that both the Marios used to dress in the flat Fitzroy black. Like that's how they were dressed when they opened the place. And Massimo came in and he said, no, I'm going to wear a waistcoat and a tie. And that's how everyone, wow, all of them dress. So.
And just, sorry, when you're in Rome and you noticed the similarities, where was the significant departure for you?
I mean, it's hard to tell because so much of Roman dining culture that I encountered was really, you know, they deal with a lot of tourists, basically. Mm. And so it's hard to tell how much of that kind of like slightly annoyed facade is just because I don't speak Italian.
Yeah.
And how much of it is inherent. But I do think that the warmth underneath it, that true family feel. I think that you can get that in some Italian restaurants, but it's the combination of the two that I felt were so so true to Massimo and to Melbourne to a certain extent, is like that gruffness that is kind of hiding this very loving interior that is pretty easy to get to if you can, if you appreciate the gruffness, you get to the love pretty easily. And that's not something that I saw in Italy in the same way. Mm. It was one or the other there. Mm. It's either gruff or really friendly. Like, yeah, it's not that combination of both. Yeah.
Well, what a year. It seems almost aptly dramatic to go from the celebration of,
yeah,
40 years and then this sadness.
Yeah, I know. I think that they've had such a high and then a pretty sad wrap up to it. But at the same time, I'm so glad that he got to see that 40 year celebration, that he got to be in the middle of it. My brother took a bunch of photos for Boothby of the celebration, and I really recommend you go look at them. They're beautiful, and most of them are of Massimo kind of in the middle of all of these kind of really loving people who have been, you know, he's been feeding for 40 years, some of them, and some for, you know, there's a picture of the young woman I was talking about, Dottie, dancing with him out the front. And it's just, mm-hmm, it's so full of joy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really, really glad that he got to that at least.
All right. Yeah. Well, Beshra Odell, it's great to have you back in
Thanks.
Studio. Massimo De Sora passed away aged 69 Monday afternoon after a brief illness. Thanks so much. We'll see you again soon.
Okay.
Independently yours, Triple R.
102.7.
Liz is in Europe at the moment and on a plane yesterday got struck by lightning.
Oh.
And serves her right for going on holidays without me.
Wow.
But all fine. She said she's never been so scared in her life. That she tensed up so much that when she got off the plane, she said, it feels like I've been to the gym. Like,
oh,
I'm physically sore.
Goodness.
Wow. Yeah.
holding, clenching everything. Yeah.
Clenching everything until they landed.
And she wasn't with any... Was she solo?
Solo, yeah. Man. And then she said the pilot came over and was like, oh, it's not that uncommon.
So she knew that's what had happened? You could tell.
Big bang, big flash. And then thought she was going to die. And then it was all okay.
And did the plane rumble? Did it move around?
Yeah, she was like the worst turbulence she'd ever felt.
Wow.
And I was like, where are you now? And she was like, I'm in a pub. What else could I do after something like that?
Fair.
Yeah. And she's like, and I will be here for the rest of the day. And I thought, great. Do you know, like, I think that's a good response. Go get a drink. I'm really glad she didn't go full carpe diem.
Oh, and yeah, go get a tattoo and then or something.
Yeah. I'm just like, I'd be like, we've got to call off the engagement. I'm in no mood to live life.
And just for the rest. I'm out of the club. I'm going to Bergen. And
yeah. This is good news. We're in a polycule.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Happy birthday. He's a red balloon voucher. I don't want to go on an adventure.
I've had so many of those expire. Like, choose my own. And no.
No.
Choose my own adventure.
Horse riding?
Choose it for me and I'll do it.
Did everyone freak out?
Yeah, everyone freaked out.
That makes it so much worse.
Everyone freaking out?
Yeah, because you might go, oh, I guess it's a bit of a storm. And then everyone goes, ah!
You just got to look for the hostie, right?
Yes.
If they look scared, then it's...
It's all over.
It's all over.
And did they? How were they?
I haven't asked. I'll have to ask her that.
Do you think it'd be comforting that everyone would be freaking out in different languages? What a global communal experience this is.
Well, I don't know. You don't want to have people freaking...
You don't know what they're saying.
Yeah. Mm. Are they freaking out... And talking about me?
Are they talking about how I'm freaking out in a racist way somehow? I was on a flight from Osaka to KL. Not a very like popular flight. So it was kind of like a half empty plane.
Yep.
Half full, depending how you look at it. And we went through this really bad turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
And then an alert came on the speaker and it said, attention, attention, we have lost pressure. And I just was like, I don't know what that means or if that's an accident. And it kind of like, we have lost pressure, and it kind of cut off, and I thought maybe it was an accident. And then the flight attendants started like running around but kind of giggling.
That's worse.
And so I just – and then they're like, put your seatbelts on, and then we – the turbulence finished. There was no explanation, and no one came on the loudspeaker and said, this is what happened. And then we all just acted like nothing had happened, and we landed. And then I remember when we got back to the hotel, we were talking about it, and Will cried. He's a crier, to be fair, but he was like, I was so scared.
I didn't say anything.
No mask dropped down, and I don't know if we actually did lose pressure, like,
or someone. What would be great if in the hostie training they're taught to giggle. Like, don't let them see you panic.
Maybe
so when
they
you run around up and down.
Yeah, they're like, I'm just going to call my loved ones. Yeah, it was awful. It was so bad. And just absolutely no care for the passengers to explain what had happened, what that meant. Was it just someone pressing the wrong button? Were we plummeting? I'll never know. But
You'll never know.
We got there safely.
Was it? I flew a budget airline and we landed in Malaysia. But we had to – nothing bad happened on the flight, but we sat on the tarmac for so long that at one point the pilot got over the speaker and just sang Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, a cappella, start to finish.
Nice.
Yeah, it was incredible. Like, it's because you know that song, it starts kind of soft and it's building. And
it's
I was
a bit
like,
Muzak at the start.
Yeah. I was like, oh, someone's proposing. And then no one came out. And the song just kept going.
And then you do the ba-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah, people. I mean, it was so it's a budget Asian carrier. So there's a lot of people where the first, like, top of their list is full moon parties. Mm. So they got into it. They were doing the backup trumpets. People are banging on the roof.
I mean, great.
You did the whole song. It was incredible.
That's a risk. Like, if you're the pilot thinking, okay, people are going to be pretty pissed off, I'll sing.
The weird thing about that song is, so it's deeply romantic, but according to the lyrics, they haven't touched.
Canting. Mm.
You'd be heaven to touch. Like, you haven't even gone to first base.
No, no, no. It's it's unrequited.
Yeah, right.
And I'll just see it all day now.
Man, it'd be dragged off the tarmac by HR. Oh.
I didn't touch her. It's in the song.
I just said it would be good. And, like, have a look.
Yeah.
You cannot deny it, Your Honour.
I asked for a snap. That's it.
That song, all I think of is 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah, 100%.
Perfect use of that song. Wow, okay. Mm. Next time I'm in a pickle, I might just start...
Just start it.
Singing a ballad quietly.
Because, you know, you bring people in, you start soft.
Were they a good singer?
Like, no.
Oh.
It was like they weren't like awful, but it was like karaoke voice.
Yeah, great.
You know?
They weren't fun. They weren't hoping there was like a scout in the plane to go,
no,
you're going to be a star.
Is there a producer from The Voice on there?
No, there wasn't. Spin that chair around, but don't recline.
Yeah. Did Will cry?
I regret saying that.
No. But it sounded like there was a release. He was a stoic in the moment.
Yes. Yeah.
And because other people, this is the thing, if they give you information, some people can't be trusted with the information.
Mm.
They will, the information will make them hysterical.
Yeah.
So, I'm all about transparency, but maybe I've changed. People can't handle the truth.
Even if they just said, oh, there was turbulence, we're all good now, but I think it was just like nothing. And I was like, was that in my head?
But then it's like if they got on the speaker and was like, oh, that was an accident, we didn't mean to press that button,
you'd be like, what else are you pressing?
Put this plane down.
Bring it down. I don't care. I will go back to
Osaka. I don't care if we are in the ocean. I need to be off.
I think you want to die with lots of people screaming in different languages and then putting the air hostess or whatever on the speaker going, hee hee.
Yeah.
Whoopsie. No worries.
Woo! That's right. Triple R. Weird science. Elastic tubes and bots and bins. Bits and pieces and magic from the hands will make it weird science.
Dr. Jen's here with Weird Science. Morning, Dr. Jen.
Good morning. I thought we should talk about this big new study that came out that is tackling one of the biggest modern health anxieties, and that is, does using a mobile phone increase your risk of cancer? Which, I don't know, like, how do you feel about that? I just feel like it's one of those things that you hear over and over again from different people over many years, and you're like, well, maybe there is some truth in it. I'm sure there's not. I'm certain there's not. But what if there is? Oh, my gosh.
It feels like it could be if someone came out and said it was true. But then when everyone on the planet is on a phone so much,
yeah,
wouldn't
it was a big thing.
Everyone have cancer?
Yeah, because it was a big thing, I feel like, in the early 2000s where not everybody carried around a phone all the time, and all the phone did was make calls.
Yep.
And then people didn't want to put it near their ear. Mm. But now it's like, well, everyone does it. So if one goes down, we're all going down.
But is there anything with radiation, right? I feel like, you remember the microwave? Do you remember microwaves? But no, there was like a time where it's like, don't stand in front of the microwave, but like fry your ovaries.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. Mm.
Well, we're going to talk about microwaves because it's part of the same story. Mm-hmm. Moscow comes into it, the Cold War. Like this is a story that just keeps on giving. So obviously I want to be very clear. The short answer to the question is no, our mobile phones are not giving us cancer. And I guess the point of this story is that we now have really substantial evidence to back that up, and that's the point. So this is a new study that was published this week, written by two researchers here in Melbourne at WEHI, at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. And what they've done is pull together the findings of this huge body of work that was commissioned by the World Health Organization back in 2019. So 13 separate massive reviews, each one digging into a different aspect of the health effects of electromagnetic waves, essentially. So the point of what the World Health Organization wanted to do was say, let's look at every piece of every research study that's ever been done on this stuff, bring it all together and see what it tells us. And the WHO hasn't published their findings yet. It's still ongoing since 2019. But these researchers said, well, we've finished our bit, so let's kind of get it out into the world. And their conclusion is that there's no evidence that electromagnetic waves from mobile phones cause cancer of the brain or the head or the neck. So that's good to know, right? Mm-hmm. But I thought...
Fortunately, your testicles are cactus.
Everything below the neck.
Yeah, the rest of you is screwed, but... but I think, like what you said about microwaves, so I thought we should just do a really quick little physics lesson, and that is to make the point that electromagnetic radiation, which gets a really bad rap, it's not one thing, it's a spectrum, right? So you can see there are figures out there that you can look at that show electromagnetic radiation goes from very, very low energy to very, very high energy. And radio waves, which are allowing people to listen to us right now and the ones that our phone use, they're right down the weak end. So they're long wavelengths, low energy. So then you go up to microwaves, mm-hmm. little bit more energy, up through infrared, up to visible light, up to ultraviolet, right up to the far end is where you have X-rays and gamma rays. So it's kind of understandable that people are nervous because they're sort of all the same thing, but they're not because of this massive spectrum. And the really important dividing line you've got to understand is that somewhere up at the ultraviolet end of this range, at roughly 10 to 12 electron volts of energy, you don't need to remember those numbers, but the point being, right up that far end, radiation becomes what we call ionizing. What the hell is ionizing? That means that every little individual packet of energy is powerful enough to knock an electron clean out of the atom and break the chemical bonds that hold molecules together, including the bonds in your DNA.
Wow.
So if you break DNA badly enough, often enough, then you can start the process that leads to cancer. So it is absolutely true that at some level that this electromagnetic radiation up the high end, the high energy end, can cause problems. That's why we wear sunscreen, because that's what sun does to us. That's why we're careful with X-rays.
That's why they go stand in the car park.
Exactly. That's why they go and stand somewhere
else.
It
makes you feel so confident, doesn't it?
They're like, I'm going to stand behind this lead shield.
Okay. What do I get?
Don't ask the question. But everything below that line where we say it's now considered to be ionizing. So visible light, infrared, microwaves, radio waves, that's non-ionizing, and they just don't carry enough energy to break chemical bonds. So what that means is that when your tissues absorb that energy, it doesn't snap anything, it doesn't break anything, it doesn't damage your DNA. It just makes your molecules jiggle a little bit. Mm-hmm. Jiggly molecules basically means it gets warmer. So that's how microwave ovens work, that the molecules of your food are jiggling around a bit and getting warm, but it's not actually doing any damage.
Just jiggling around. Yeah. Just let them jiggle.
Just getting jiggly with it.
Exactly. The jiggling is really, really good. So the key thing to know then is that a mobile phone isn't a little X-ray device being held next to your head, that ideally you should have a lead shield between your phone and your head. It's operating at the other end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. and there is no way we possibly understand that your phone has the capacity to do damage that could cause cancer. Mm-hmm. Like, so there's just no mechanism there.
Did people just run away with this idea? Like, was there any malicious intent with spreading? Was this disinformation or misinformation?
Look, I think bits of both, and this is where the Cold War comes in, which is really crazy, right? So, you know, hopefully I've convinced you the physics is really clear. So then we should say, well, why has this anxiety stuck around so much, and why is it always there and people are getting worried about it? And this is where the roots go back to the Cold War. So that was the era when microwaves and televisions were brand new and they were arriving in people's homes for the first time. And, of course, new technologies, invisible waves, you know, how the hell does a microwave work? You know, things that people don't really understand very well. Of course, you know, there would be concern. And at the same time, everyone knew by this stage that high energy radiation could genuinely cause cancers like leukemia. So, of course, there's some anxiety. And then there was this crazy episode that really cemented the fear. And this is where the Soviets, during the Cold War, the Soviets aimed a microwave beam at the US Embassy in Moscow. And when the ambassador later developed leukemia people put the two together and said that it was the microwave beams that were caused that ambassador's leukemia. Now, when it was properly studied, there were no health effects that showed up as a result of what the Soviets were doing. The exposure that those staff got was actually higher than what we get from mobile towers today. But there was no, you know, so you can understand why people were nervous, right? It seemed like a crazy thing to happen. So, you know, this secret microwave, a sick diplomat, you know, even though there was no science there, it kind of cemented this fear and this myth that then continued. So I think what happened was that radiation became this one, you know, this one scary word.
A catch-all.
A catch-all phrase which actually covers lots of different things. And the distinction between the X-ray at one end and the humble radio wave at the other just got completely lost. Then mobile phones arrive and we hold them against our heads for however many hours a day, and we've got this modern kind of home for our anxiety, I suppose. So I don't know, like, yes, misinformation, yes, disinformation, yes, just this sense of, you know, this is a mass experiment. What if it does? What if our phones do cause cancer? When are we going to when are we going to realise, and will it be too late to do anything about it? And there's another thing that I think is really important, and that's something that fuels a lot of the headlines, and that is that back in 2011, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified radio frequency radiation as, in inverted commas, possibly carcinogenic to humans, in this classification band called 2B, which sounds alarming, right? It got lots of coverage. People are like, oh, you know, it's possibly carcinogenic. We should be really scared about that. But group 2B actually means something very specific. It's not a measure of how dangerous something is. It's a measure of how strong the evidence that we have is. And 2B is essentially saying, look, we can't rule it out for sure, but the evidence is really limited. That's what that means. So to give you a sense of the company that mobile phones hold, you know, are accompanied by in that grouping, aloe vera whole leaf extract is also in 2B. And I discovered traditional Asian pickled vegetables are also in 2B. So it's like, how risky is it versus how much evidence do we have? And I guess people just get tripped up all the time. So sunlight is in the top category. It's definitely carcinogenic. But, like, nobody says don't ever go outside. We manage the risk. We wear sunscreen. And meanwhile, the fact that mobile phone or that the waves were in 2B, it tells you that, you know, the science is just a bit thin, not that it's a really kind of menacing risk. Interestingly, coffee sat in group 2B for many, many years, but was shifted in 2016 as the evidence got better. So, you know, we have to recognise that I think those things, as soon as you hear possibly carcinogenic, even though it's not good evidence, we get worried about it.
It's a scary word because it's associated with, like, cigarettes. And,
yeah, 100%. But I think, you know, so now there's been huge amounts of studies, and interestingly, a lot of the good work's come out of Melbourne. We should feel very proud. We have consistent findings from many, many studies now that there's no association between mobile phone use and brain cancer or any other head or neck cancer. It doesn't matter how much you use your phone. It doesn't matter how many hours, how many calls you make. It doesn't matter whether you've been using a phone for 10 years or 20 years or 1 year. Like, there's just no increased risk. And I think what you guys said before is the most important. Like, if mobile phones increase the risk of brain cancer, we'd expect to see rates of brain cancer going up, right? We've all been using phones for decades now, and that's never happened. So if you look back, you know, in the mid-1980s, almost nobody had a mobile phone.
Today, I think you're about to say almost nobody had brain cancer.
Wow, what were they doing?
No, that's the whole point. So the rates of brain cancer haven't really changed at all in the last few decades, yet if you go back to the mid-1980s, essentially nobody had a mobile phone. Fast forward to today, essentially everybody has a mobile phone. If mobile phones cause brain cancer, we would have seen this massive increase in brain cancer rates, and we just haven't seen that. So I just think it's one of these very interesting stories that there's all these little snippets of evidence that people have heard, have been frightened about, completely reasonably have held on to, just in case, you know, just in case I'm wrong.
Can worrying needlessly about cancer cause cancer?
Well, I mean, that's a really excellent question, right?
That's in 2B.
And I guess, like, the whole point is, you know, science, you know, no science can prove the absence of risk, right? Mm. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how science operates. So, of course, if this is something that's feels to you emotionally like, oh, there could be a problem. This phone feels like it could be causing me damage. I understand why people get worried about it.
Well, just
it
causes damage
in other ways, right? But I think it's great that this research has come out of Melbourne. It's very clear. This is, of the billions of things to worry about in your life, this is not one of them. Using your phone, even 24/7, yeah, might be really bad for you in other ways, but it is not going to give you cancer.
All right. So you're saying don't spend $50 on the EMF blocking straw that I saw on Instagram.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
She's going to gift you one. So you need
to buy it. So that's right. Dr. Jen's got her own line.
Definitely done, Dr. Jen. Like the scalpel that we don't need anymore. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Jill Wilcock is the internationally acclaimed film editor behind six of the 20 highest grossing Australian films of all time, with credits including Muriel's Wedding, Red Dog, The Dressmaker, Dogs in Space, Strictly Ballroom, Evil Angels, Head On, Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award to go alongside her swag of BAFTA nominations, AFI and Actor Awards, as well as her appointment as a companion of the Order of Australia and her receiving of Australia's Centenary Medal for service to Australian society and film production. Jill is the focus of the Acme series Focus on Jill Wilcock, which brings together some of her most iconic films, and here to tell us about it, the filmmaker and erstwhile Bollywood starlet joins us now. Jill, welcome to Breakfasters.
I like the Bollywood bit.
Well, you popped up in some Bollywood films, is that
Unfortunately,
fair?
Unfortunately, yes. Very bad bid scene. Fully clothed, of course, in Bollywood.
Oh, is that so?
At that time.
So you had to overcome that to convey the sensuality?
Well, the blonde hair was enough. And it was the villain of the movie, of course. It was his girlfriend.
Oh, okay. The blonde villain.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Now, what's this like for you, having this compendium of your films?
Embarrassing.
That list of credits was so long we almost ran out of time for the interview.
I was like, I guess that's all. Let's see you later. Embarrassing why?
Oh, I don't really like, I mean, if you're an editor, you want to be behind the scenes. Mm. I don't want to be on set. And it's just odd. I mean, you do these movies and you think, yeah, oh, that was so hard. Thank God that's finished. It was so hard. Because editing, you just go down a tunnel and you're just stuck there for so long when it's a feature. Mm. It's a really hard thing. They don't just come together.
Can I ask how many times would you have seen one of those films that you've edited? Could you count?
No. Impossible. Totally impossible. You mean by working with it and sitting with a director?
Yeah.
I don't like going to the movie. I'm going to go and see a couple of these, though, with friends. But that's about it. But I looked in on Death in Brunswick. I did a bit on the end of it, and I want to go and see that again because, you know, of
Sam Neill's passing.
Not just that, and the lovely
John Clark.
Mm. That partnership and friendship was beautiful, and so that would be a lovely memory to see that. And I think it's on Saturday too, so nice. Acme, yeah.
It's so interesting you say you don't want to be on set, but from what I can gather, you can be a bit of a lifesaver. Am I right on Strictly Ballroom? You were shooting some coverage that was valuable in the editing room?
Well, that was a unique experience because they've come straight from theatre and they were pretty dependent on having somebody that had done, you know, film before. And so they sort of did a live day at an actual ballroom competition, and we only got the lunchtime to get on the floor and do most of that end scene, the dancing with the crowds, etc. So, because we wanted to utilise free crowds. And so I just grabbed a camera and did some of the crowds. And then that night, that was a Saturday, and that night we stayed up all night and waited for the lab to say that the film had been processed, because we had Sunday in that empty space to do any pickups. Mm. So we rushed into the lab, horror. Everything was fine, but we could see what we still needed to get. And the next day we did sort of more pickups, etc. But that film in particular, because that dance at the end was a particular length in reality, the film needed it longer to make, to include, to be, for me to be able to cut away and finish all the other stories that we were completing on the film. So I had to find bits of magnetic, tape to cut up and remake another part of the musical piece to make it long enough to extend through to make the finale dramatic enough.
But you'd have anticipated that, perhaps?
No. No.
Okay.
No.
Wow.
No, not at the time, no. You have no idea because you haven't even cut. They did lots of the little stories in the dressing rooms around of the other characters and in backstage. We could do those pickups the next day on the Sunday. And also, you don't know how long those stories are. You're going to need to complete them until you've done the whole movie to round it all up. And Baz is a master of telling many, many stories at once. And, it's happened to me on Moulin Rouge, it's happened to me on everything I've done with him, that I end up going bang, 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 bang. Everybody's story has to come and finish, towards the end.
God. How do you like that frenetic pace of his films?
I love it, but it's not necessarily my style. I mean, the problem is it's the directors you choose. So if you go to Sam Mendes, who's a very serious theatre director, you're not cutting Moulin Rouge, Jill. Right? It's desperate. You've really got to take on the personality of the director, and it's the director's film, not mine. Those three first films are my collaboration with Baz because of that's the way we got on and that's the way I felt he wanted to tell his stories.
But say for Japanese story, you're prepared to linger.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's another director with another style, and there's a particular thing that she wanted me to portray, which is how difficult it can be if you get into a situation, which our audience may see if they go when they see Japanese story, and her being an ex-nurse knew the reality of it. So I took into account that was a very special part of the story. And that it should be observed how you treat a situation like that.
Do you think about soul much? Obviously the actors love you. They trust you intuitively, and the directors love you, and everyone entrusts you to tell the story in a way that is soulful and true.
Well, I hope to do. But people get a thing, like Shekhar Kapoor, he saw Romeo and Juliet, and he did an extraordinary film a long time ago called Banded Queen. And he desperately wanted me to cut his movie. But I was actually editing head on. And everybody here said, here's a big chance, international picture. Drop head on. I said, I'm not dropping head on. No way.
Yeah.
It's tough. I can't, I was in the middle of head on with Anna, and I was devoted to what she wanted and also finishing that movie. So the sneaky director, the minute they finished shooting, rang me and said, you will cut my film. It is your destiny.
Destiny. Is there a bit of a curse being such a well-trusted director? Does anyone go, we've got Jill on this, we'll fix it in post?
Oh, no.
No.
No. Look, I think every single person that gets involved in making a film is terrified. It's a big responsibility because financially everybody invests in it. I don't ever see it as a job. I see it as a lucky form of my expression. And I feel that it was just accidental and I fell into it and that was the area I took. But it suits me because I don't really want to be, poncing about out with the others.
You hear a lot about with editing things being left on the cutting room floor. Are there certain things you've had to edit out that you wish you didn't? Have you ever, has it been done with difficulty or you?
No, I've kind of won those battles.
Mm.
And that's the good about having a bit, you must really try and understand what the director wants, even if it's not necessarily your taste or what you might think. You have to go down that path to find out what it is they're trying to do, and also then they can make the decision whether it should be eliminated if they haven't succeeded to do it the right way.
Mm. Mm. You've played, you've paid enormously close attention to actors like Cate Blanchett or Kate Winslet or Tom Hanks and Paul Newman. Do you see them in the rushes switch it on for a take, or is there a glow throughout all of the footage that you see?
They're just incredible professionals. Most of them just, they don't muck about. They just wait and then they do their job. They've come to do a job. They're getting paid really well. And also, they do their homework.
Mm.
They're extraordinary. I mean, if you look at that list of actors, in Road to Perdition, extraordinary, Jude Law, Daniel Craig, Tom Hanks. There was even Anthony LaPaglia, but his scene was too interesting and we had to cut it out.
Wow.
Oh.
Only because he played the most, famous gangster, Al Capone, and the story is a gentle boy father story, and suddenly in the middle of it you cut to Al Capone. Everyone goes, oh, that's interesting. So he gets a special thank you.
Oh, but the whole thing was cut out.
Yeah, it just would change the whole, feeling of the film.
Yeah, crowd out. Crowd was important out. For
Absolutely.
The story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what about now? Where are you? Actually, we have to come up to the news. Would you mind sticking around just a little bit after the news?
Okay. Love to hear the news.
We're going to have a flesh. We've been speaking with Jill Belcop. Triple R. We're here with iconic film editor Jill Bilcock amid her suite of films being screened at ACME as part of their focus on Jill Bilcock. What about comedy?
Comedy is very, very difficult. And when I sort of read Muriel's Wedding, I felt like, oh, she's going to keep sticking her tongue out. she's not a lizard. And so in the end, you realise that you can edit it in a way that, less is more, and you work around it and you find the best of it. But a very interesting thing that I learnt from Rob Sitch when I did The Dish is that you don't make fun of, you shouldn't feel that you want to make fun of your characters, you should love your characters. That's why people love The Castle, right?
Mm-hmm.
They love those people, and they're not necessarily the people you hang out with or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so comedy is about actually loving your characters, no matter how extreme and weird they are, and getting the best out of it.
Mm. But you never linger long in your cuts. Like you give the audience credit to get a joke and crack on with it.
I don't know how that happens. That's just I'm lucky that I know when to get out, I think.
Mm.
But I don't really want to see too much. I mean, you've really got to keep moving.
Yeah.
And yeah, well, I think that point is that if you stay on them too long, then you are making fun of them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't keep moving. If you just include them as their characters and keep them, getting on with everybody else in the scene, I think it's more helpful for them too.
What would Jill Bilcock be like to sit next to watching a film or like a television Gogglebox? Are you like screaming, going, oh, that was a bit heavy-handed? Or
No.
You can enjoy
Definitely
it.
Definitely not. No, I love them. I'm trying. Well, I'd probably leave if it was that bad.
But you must get, do you still reflect on, of all the footage you've seen, and you must have obsessed over things that never even made the final cut, and do you?
No, don't worry. Don't worry about it. That is actually helped something dramatically, and it's a really good feeling that you've had that courage to do that, and also that the director sees that it's improved.
Mm.
It's very, very important. But, the director is still my boss, and he or she is like, they will always sometimes, you know, the ones that are very insecure keep trying things over and over again. But I've kind of run out of that patience.
Mm. Yeah.
I went through a lot of it, cutting TV commercials a long time ago when I started out just to make money. And it's like you just realise that when you've done it, you've done it. Get on with it. And they love it, you know, they can see it. And because what it does, it takes up their original piece, that little notch further. And also taking stuff out. I mean, Baz referred to me as the bogus detector. Mm-hmm. If something's bad, it's out straight away. If it's seriously bad. And also, say on Muriel's Wedding, there was a scene that was really bad. So what it had happened? To be reshot, you know.
What was so bad about it?
It was just, it just didn't work and the humour wasn't working and probably the actor was nervous. It was just a combination. Nobody's fault really, but it just, you know, it would flop.
And are you on set? Do you spend much time on set? You're never on set.
They call me out sometimes, but I hate it.
Yeah. Why do you hate it?
Well, I don't want to be involved about, if they've got 10,000 extras and I cut it out, I don't want to feel bad about it.
Oh, you don't want to look them in the eye.
No. But, you know, if 10,000 extras wasn't needed, it goes.
So do you think maybe not being on set and you're a pair of fresh eyes, so when it comes to you, you can easily see objectively that it's an unnecessary scene or it doesn't
work?
Much better. Yeah, okay.
I mean, Moulin Rouge, because they just kept shooting and shooting that tango over and over again. I never written the end. Thought, well, what are we looking for here? I don't know, but Baz would... So I had to come down to the set at 5 o'clock every day. And he'd make a big deal of it and I'd get really embarrassed.
A big deal of you?
Yeah, coming down. It's like, you know, it was like just making a coffee break or something to make fun of Jill. So creep off back to my room and hide.
Were you wandering around these very streets during the editing of Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah. Haven't you seen it? Go down the creek. There's a... In the doco, there's Baz and all of us used to go every afternoon because I'm on the corner of Ryan and Victoria in that big two-story, they call it Art and Craft.
Oh, you don't want to tell it. Yeah.
No, it's right. Not on air. I don't live there at all. I live in a high-rise apartment. Anyway, no, we would have a afternoon break, which we'd walk along the creek to the Russian church and back.
How important are those breaks? Because I'd imagine you'd get pretty focused and myopic.
I think fun is very important. We have a lot of fun and there's a lot of silliness goes on in most films with my team. A lot of dress-ups, a lot of mucking about, you know. It's just good.
Have you getting...
Cocktails.
What time are cocktails?
Oh, well, usually about, like, they can... If it's a long day, we'll have one at 5 and then one at 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, great. God.
With takeaway.
What's your go-to?
Oh, usually Asian food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you get credit for this... Romeo and Juliet piece with Leonardo DiCaprio, like a short teaser?
Oh, yeah, I do those.
Yeah.
I did all that.
Now, that's people need to be persuaded visually, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
And is that...
And then I use it. But with Moulin Rouge, they wanted to... they never shot one side of the drive-in at the beginning where they come in the car. So... we wanted to get some more money halfway through, so I cut 14 minutes of material together with all kinds of music and so forth. Baz would, you know, help me with the music, finding bits and pieces and stuff like that. He was great. But in the end, that taught me and Baz that if we didn't keep putting typography up, people will never learn it, who's the Capulet and who's the Montague, right? So it was all about doing all this constant... You know, absolute information all the time to introduce your characters and also to create rhythm, to get you sorted by what you were going in for.
And you've got an intuition about how to hold their hand without beating them over the head.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no. Look, all the directors I choose are highly creative and exceptional people and I've been very lucky because I've been able to choose who I work with pretty well. And or I've fallen in with people that were highly talented. I was taken from Swinburne by Fred Skepsey and Evil Angels. I was only meant to be cutting the TV screens. They'd asked international editors that he'd worked with before and they were unable to do it. And I got the whole gig very, very young, which was enormous. And it was on film, which is quite difficult. And they were right up in the, you know, north of Australia. So I was back here. I went up and about halfway through. But that was... He actually gave me that first start, which is huge.
Yeah.
You know, with Meryl Streep and all the...
Do you feel the weight of, say, when Meryl Streep is opening the tent and looking for a baby, do you feel the weight of that responsibility telling that story when you're in the
That one, definitely. And I also had the information of how far it was from here to there. That's the only time I've actually relied on the truth.
Oh, okay.
It was essential to do that. Like to know that this is where the tent was, this is the time she went, et cetera, et cetera. And no, there was paperwork from documents.
A lot of the films you've worked on are iconic and well-loved, like Muriel's Wedding and Romeo and Juliet. And are there any that you have worked on that maybe are sort of private favourites for yours or that you think are... go underappreciated or less noticed?
No, not really. I think most of them have...
You haven't done anything that's underappreciated, I reckon.
That's good. Must be nice.
Yeah.
Do you know when you're working on them? Like when you're cutting together Muriel's Wedding, do you know it's going to be a hit?
No,
or
no,
are you
I was
just...
terrified.
Oh.
that one, because once again, the opening scene of people being really cruel to Muriel... Mm. And this is coming back to Rob Sitch, you know.
Being kind.
Yeah. And it was a hard lesson to learn because it was terrifying. Those girls were just so horrible. But the point is that they're even lovable for who they are as meanies because they're so obviously the character that they can't not be.
Let's have a look at these films that... are being presented in your honour and the focus on you at ACME. Now, Elizabeth is screening again on the 1st of August and screening tomorrow.
I'd love to talk about that a bit.
Yeah?
Mainly because, you know, it was a story that had a lot more real detail in it about, you know, the bad guys doing this and that, but it kind of didn't work. So... and there was an awful lot of people running around in corridors all the time and you never knew who they were and what was happening, etc. So with that, Shaker and I decided, okay, we're just going to go with the money, Cate Blanchett. Mm-hmm. Let's just go with the money here. Forget the we have to tell this religious saga, you know, the Pope and the blah, blah, blahs and the this and that. There is a rather gorgeous young... priest, though, that turned out, which we all loved, and it was Daniel Craig as a young man.
Wow.
Yeah, really gorgeous.
And so that Elizabeth turned into a film that maybe people didn't foresee when it started.
I think there's a bit of smoke and mirrors, I'd say.
Right,
incredible. To get it together because, as I said, he has that fabulous style of getting up so high and there's this, there's Jeffrey Rush like an ant walking.
Well, and we've mentioned Head On, and Strikebound is playing on Saturday in a 4K restoration. Have you? When was the last time you watched this film?
I haven't seen it since. I think I will go and see that restored. And, you know, Richard was my assistant. Then suddenly he was my boss.
Richard Lowenstein.
Yeah, yeah. So that was an interesting... kind of little partnership, and you know he'd want to be going out clubbing, and I'd help put on his eyeliner.
Can I quickly, as a sidestep, did you edit Mystify, the Michael Hutchence documentary? Or were you associated with that at all?
I did start on it.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I just noticed that there were no talking heads, which was unusual.
No, he only gave a sound. And the reason I couldn't go on with it, I was worried that we weren't being kind enough to him.
Right, okay. Mm. Well, then Dogs in Space is on Saturday as well, which is just an iconic Melbourne film. Do people talk to you about that very often?
Yeah, all over the world. Wow. Here's a DVD, will you sign it?
Mm. Oh, dead set.
Yeah, it's lovely. You know, it's really good. And, you know, Richard is an extremely talented director. And I think we just grew apart for me to be able to do that. It was too restricting for me. And, you know, they're capable of doing it themselves anyway. He's a very good editor.
Yeah.
Excellent editor. So there's no problem there.
And are you expecting a party for Strictly Ballroom screening? I mean, that'll go off, won't it?
I don't know.
People love to see that together in a cinema.
They do, don't they? Mm. Yeah. It is a fun film. It's so funny, that one. Oh, my God. And, you know, look, I came from a family of teachers and union leaders. The news was just like, oh, God, I'm growing up. You know, I'm a teenager listening to those strikes.
The striking teachers, yeah.
And my mother became a principal. She founded the Whitehorse Tech and everything. She was a really dynamic leader in the unions as well. So, and so was Richards, and our mothers knew each other. So we had that in common. But now I've lost the thread. What was the question again?
We were speaking of seeing Strictly Ballroom.
Oh, yeah, Strictly Ballroom. Yeah, no, parties would be great. Does Acme do parties?
Oh, well, even if it's just a vibe.
I think he's thinking more of people going woo in the crowd. That's about.
Oh, maybe they will now.
Yeah.
Maybe as wild as it gets at Acme.
Yeah. There'll be Evil Angels, Romeo and Juliet, Road to Perdition is being screened, which was Paul Newman's last role, is that right?
That's right.
Wow.
Lucky you didn't edit him out.
Oh, I'd never edit him out. And that was he was so gorgeous because I did say this in the conversation, but it's good for your listeners. When you start a film, you all sit around and you introduce each other, you know. And so it goes, you know, DP, blah, 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 da, 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 da. Jill Bilcock, editor. Paul Newman, spaghetti sauce. That's what he said.
Because that's what he makes. Well,
makes fun of himself.
That's very important.
Amazing. Well, this focus on Jill Bilcock is taking place at Acme. It kicked off on the 16th of July and screenings go till the 3rd of August. It's very exciting. It's been a great pleasure to have you in the studio. I do wonder briefly just about choices. You make a lot of choices in the editing room. What do you like when you see a menu? Are you as... like in a restaurant, or do you get choice paralysis in other areas, but you're a savant in the editing room?
No. I don't have any problems there. Love going out, love food.
Yeah.
And I could actually go through the whole, you know, eat each dish if possible.
but just on that, you think we all are natural editors?
Absolutely. Well, of course we are, because as you grow up, you have to edit. You have to be kind to people who don't need to hear something, particularly your mother.
Nah.
Right? And, you know, if anyone, you just have to be, you know, you have to have that kind of filter.
Yes, be judicious and curate your own behaviour.
Right. Yeah. Don't tell the truth all the time.
I love it. Well, thanks for oversharing with us this morning, Jill Bilcock, and you can head to Acme's website for more information.
Melbourne's own RRR.
Thanks for listening to the best bits of Breakfasters. Catch us live on RRR every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m. or listen on demand at rrr.org.au or on the RRR app. You can get in touch with us via Instagram, Facebook or the RRR website.